At around 3:45 a.m. on October 4th, 2011, Jeremy Irwin came home from a late-night electrical job to find the front door unlocked and the lights still on inside his Kansas City home. As he walked through the house, turning off lights and checking on his children, he made a chilling discovery. His nearly 11-month-old daughter, Lisa, was gone. Lisa had last been seen the night before at around 6:40 p.m. when her mother, Deborah Bradley, said she put her in her crib. Within those 9 hours, Lisa vanished without a trace. In the days that followed, detectives found burned baby clothes in a nearby dumpster, and multiple people reported seeing a man walking with a baby in the middle of the night near the Irwin home. But Lisa was never found. More than 14 years later, her disappearance remains one of Kansas City's most haunting unsolved cases, leaving everyone asking, what happened to baby Lisa? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, so baby Lisa's case. We have received a lot of requests for this one. And I will tell you right up front that there is a lot of information to this case. So I'm going to be focusing this episode on the core info. And there's many sources you can go to. The only thing that I would advise you is try to stick to official sources, because there's a lot on Reddit, there's a lot all over the internet, and I will tell you there's certain things that I've already seen that I know are not true. So just be cognizant of the places where you're getting your information, but I will tell you there's a lot of people out there who've been following this case for many years, have been, or maybe locals to the area, and they know a lot about it and may add value to what's currently going on with the case and where it stands. But we're going to go through all the facts. I'm going to give you everything I can, and then I'm going to give you my perspective at the end. And I feel like with this one, there's a couple details about this case that is very suggestive of one particular scenario. So I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Lisa Renee Irwin was born on November 11th, 2010, to parents Deborah Bradley and Jeremy Irwin, who each had one son from previous marriages. The family lived together in a four-bedroom, two-bathroom home located at 3620 North Lister Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri. By the start of October 2011, Lisa was nearly 11 months old. Even though she was just a baby, she had an outstanding personality and smiled at everyone she met. According to her family, Lisa, quote, liked everybody. She wasn't shy and would happily go up to strangers. Now, that can be a good thing and a bad thing, but I think at that age, when you don't know better, it's nice to see that innocence. It's nice for someone to not be exposed to the outside world and just see the best in everyone. Every time I see kids, I envy them for that, because unfortunately, once you get out there, you realize it's not the case. And Lisa's family was really excited to celebrate her first birthday in just over a month, but tragically, they would never get that chance. On October 3rd, Jeremy went to work as an electrician like he did every Monday, while Deborah stayed home with Lisa, who had a cold and a cough. The boys, who were 5 and 8, went to school, and after Jeremy returned from work that afternoon, Deborah headed out to run errands and pick up groceries. When she got back home around 5 p.m., Jeremy received a call from his employer about an emergency electrical issue at the nearby Starbucks. He left soon after and responded to the service call while Deborah stayed home with the children. It ended up being a very long night for Jeremy as he worked nearly 11 hours, the latest he had ever been away for a job. At around 3:45 a.m., Jeremy returned home and noticed that the front door was unlocked. CBS News reported that as he stepped inside, nearly all the lights in the house were still on as well. This was weird, but he didn't think much of it. and so he started walking through the house, turning off lights and checking on the kids. Now, before I move forward, I think it's important to understand the layout of the Irwin home. So the first image here is pretty basic. You can see that the Irwin home is just a ranch-style home. You got the front door. You got a window to the left, which is like the entrance living room area. And then you have the two windows to the right. Now, that first window is a window in the kitchen, the one that you see in the middle there. And then the window all the way to the right would be considered the computer room. And that room and that window is going to become very important as we go forward in the story. All right, so let's get back to what Jeremy said happened when he walked through the house. When he got to the computer room that I was just referring to, he noticed that the window was open. So he went to close it, but it wouldn't shut. That's when he realized that the screen was, quote, pushed into the house about halfway. Now, he thought that was strange, but he didn't stop to investigate. He just kept moving on. In the boys' room, he found his son asleep. Deborah's son wasn't in bed, but that wasn't alarming either because Jeremy figured he was just sleeping with Deborah. Jeremy went to Lisa's room next and was surprised to find that her door was open. That immediately stood out to him because they always kept her door closed so she wouldn't be woken up by the noise. He then entered the room and walked up to Lisa's crib, but it was empty. Jeremy didn't panic right away. He thought she might just be in bed with Deborah. So he walked into their bedroom and saw Deborah's son sleeping next to her, but still no Lisa. That's when he woke Deborah up and told her that he couldn't find their daughter. Deborah and Jeremy, quote, ran around the house screaming for her, but she was nowhere. Jeremy then, quote, banged on neighbors' doors, hoping someone had seen her, but no one had. So that's when they went to call 911, but all three of their cell phones were missing from the kitchen counter. Only one of their phones actually worked, the other two had restricted service, but they had definitely been there before Deborah went to bed. Thankfully, Jeremy had his work phone, which they used to report Lisa missing. According to KCTV5, when officers arrived at the house, they searched every room but couldn't find Lisa. Patrol units fanned out into the neighborhood while detectives were called in to interview the family. Deborah and Jeremy's sons were both questioned for about a half hour, and both said they didn't hear anything because they had been asleep all night. Deborah and Jeremy, on the other hand, they were interviewed for hours. Detectives later explained that they wanted to confirm both parents' stories before issuing an Amber Alert. They needed to make sure they understood exactly what they were dealing with before activating it, and I agree with that. You want to make sure you have all the information and that it's factually accurate because this is a critical point in this case, and you don't want to disseminate misinformation because it could lead everyone in the neighborhood to be looking for something or someone that doesn't exist. So during these interviews, Jeremy told detectives that he discovered Lisa missing after he got home from work. Deborah said that at around 10:30 p.m., she fed Lisa, changed her clothes, and laid her in her crib. Then she put the boys to bed and turned off all the lights. She remembered leaving the computer room window open, but she wasn't sure if she locked the front door. She went to bed, and soon after, her son came in to lay beside her. The next thing she remembered was Jeremy waking her up and telling her Lisa was gone. After around 3 hours of questioning Deborah and Jeremy, detectives felt like they had enough evidence of an abduction to issue an Amber Alert. To help them investigate Lisa's possible abduction, multiple agencies, including the FBI and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, were brought in. The physical search continued as detectives kept interviewing Deborah and Jeremy until 10:30 that night, more than 18 hours after they first called 911. They both maintained their innocence the entire time. They said they had nothing to do with her disappearance, and they couldn't think of any reason why someone would abduct Lisa. Some of you might be saying, wow, 18 hours, that's excessive. But I think we've done enough cases together now at this point that you know you got to start at the source. You got to start at the foundation, especially when you're talking about an 11-month-old child. Statistically speaking, just from a history perspective, when you have a case like this, more than likely, one or both of the parents are involved in some way, shape, or form. So yes, you want to verify the information for any potential Amber Alert. You also want to start with the last people who saw Lisa, which would be Deborah and Jeremy, and you want to make sure that their stories match up. Is there any conflictions there? Are they corroborating each other's last reports of Lisa being around? And is there anything in their statements that suggest they could have some involvement, either directly or indirectly? Because you really have to look at this from a practical perspective, right? What they're asking you to believe is that while Deborah and the two children were sleeping, someone entered the home, either through the front door or through the window, which this was not a large house, goes in, grabs the baby, walks out, and nobody hears anything. And this whole time, this person would have had to have known that Jeremy wasn't home and nobody would wake up while they were inside the house. It's a lot to digest. Is it possible? Of course it is. And they're going to investigate it like that. But you got to start with the more reasonable potential theory here, which is that the parents know more than they're saying. So some of you may say 18 hours is excessive. I say it's warranted. Controversial opinion, maybe, but they did a thorough investigation. They did a thorough interview. And that's more than we can say for some of these stories we cover. We have a lot more to get into. We're just scratching the surface. We're going to take our first break. We'll be right back. In every true crime story, it's the little details that give someone away. It could be a receipt, a phone ping, or a habit they just couldn't hide. So here's a question. What's your habit saying about you? If you're ready to ditch the dead giveaways, start with Fume Zero, the better thing to reach for. This episode is sponsored by Fume Zero, the brand new grab-and-go flavored air device from Fume, and here's why it's different. First off, it's affordable, just $24.99 for a sleek, pre-filled device, no commitment, no refills, no batteries. It's completely clean, zero nicotine, zero vapor, just natural plant-based flavored air. It's the first truly easy way to try a good habit. With 6 bold flavors and 10 days of use, Zero makes it simple to start. I actually have the Fume Zero in my hand if you're watching on YouTube, and it's just a really cool design. Fume has really nailed how to make a product look good. They got it down to a science by this point. And this is the crisp mint. Tastes delicious. One of my favorites from the regular Fume, so no surprises here. Same great flavor, just at a cheaper price. So take zero chances with Fume Zero today, available for just $24.99. All you have to do is head over to tryfume.com. That's tryfume.com to start with Zero. Okay, we're back. And while Jeremy and Deborah were being questioned at the station for 18 hours, which we talked about before the break, investigators were busy at their home. Crime scene technicians went room by room, collecting evidence and documenting everything they found. They paid special attention to the window in the computer room. However, no fingerprints were located as far as we know. Officers also continued searching the neighborhood with police dogs. They didn't locate Lisa, but they did find something that caught their attention inside a dumpster behind an apartment complex around a fifth of a mile from the Irwin home. Burned baby clothes. Now, according to HLN, a man had reported a dumpster fire earlier that morning around 2:20 a.m. At the time, though, no one realized that the fire might be connected to Lisa's disappearance because she hadn't been reported missing, so the incident didn't raise any red flags. After detectives recovered the burned clothing, the items were shown to Deborah, but she said they didn't match what Lisa had been wearing when she was put to bed. However, it may have been some of her other clothing. As searches for baby Lisa continued, officers also canvassed the neighborhood, going door to door to see if anyone had seen or heard something unusual. One of the people they spoke to was a married couple who lived 3 houses over on the next street. Their names were Lisa and Onesto Parscale, and to make things easy as possible, especially for myself, I'm going to call them Mr. and Mr. Parscale. So according to Mr. Parscale, at around 12:15 a.m. on the night Lisa disappeared, he had seen a strange man in his late 30s or early 40s walking down the street perpendicular to Lisa's house, and that man was holding a baby. He was walking under the streetlights, which gave Mr. Parscale a clear view. He could see that the baby was, quote, wearing only a diaper, and with the time of day and the temperatures in the 40s, it immediately stood out to him. Mr. Parscale had been leaving for work when he saw the man, but he thought it was odd enough that he called his wife after getting on the road and asked her to look outside to see if she could see the man too. When Mrs. Parscale looked out the window, she saw him and the baby. Unfortunately, neither one of them called the police, and I'm not going to sit here and beat them down. I'm glad they at least came forward and told law enforcement what they knew. But guys, when you see something like this, it's better to be safe than sorry. You see someone walking down the road with a baby that's not properly clothed for the weather, and it's late at night like this. If anybody gets offended that law enforcement was called on them, if they're walking down the road with their baby when the temperature's in the 40s and they're only wearing a diaper, well, that's on them. Because if they were properly prepared for the environment, no one would have thought it was suspicious. But I'd rather you call and make sure that the baby and this person are okay than just assume, you know what? Maybe I'm overthinking it. Cops are getting paid. They're on patrol 24/7. And here's a little secret. A lot of the times they're sitting in a parking lot somewhere on their phone or on the computer. They got the time. If there's someone out there, especially a young child, and you see something that makes you go, that doesn't look right, who cares who it inconveniences? Call law enforcement. Let them do their job. Let them confirm that there's nothing going on. I'd rather be safe than sorry. And worst case scenario here, they go up to this person. There's nothing too suspicious, but at least they get a name of the person, confirm their identity, so that when something like this happens later, now they have a strong lead. So again, I would have loved if the PAR scales had called law enforcement. Unfortunately, they didn't. Nothing we can do about it now. And as it turns out, the PAR scales weren't the only ones to report seeing a man carrying a baby that night when law enforcement was going around speaking to everyone. Another witness, who I'm going to refer to as Mitch, told detectives that he saw a man with a baby around 4 a.m. near the intersection by I-435, roughly 3 miles northeast of the Irwin home. If you're on YouTube, you're seeing an image on your screen, and don't worry, I'm going to describe it for the audio listeners. But to the bottom left-hand corner, you have Baby Lisa's home. And then just a few short steps away, you have the PAR scale home. It's right around the corner from Baby Lisa's home. And then not too far from there, you have the dumpster fire, the location of it, which was reported around 2:30 a.m. So again, all in close proximity. And if you're to visualize this, they're kind of in this line where you could visualize the direction that the potential suspect had traveled. Now I'm going to have a second photo on the screen here. And this one's going to be of the third sighting that we have reported. So this is an overview of the area a little further away. So you can see Lisa's home. You can see the first sighting there, which is the PAR scale home. You have the dumpster fire, right? So this is just a pulled out view of that previous image I just showed you. And then you have the third sighting up in the top right hand corner, which is obviously a little further away. It's 3 miles on the highway. And this would suggest, especially with this guy being on foot, that he got a pretty far distance. And this probably wasn't planned, especially to walk that far at that time of night in that condition. But that's what we have. And now, if you're watching on YouTube, I know my part-time detectives out there are going, what's the surveillance video at 2:15? You haven't talked about it yet. Well, I'm going to talk about it right after I talk about Mitch. So Mitch said he was driving home from work when he spotted a man in a t-shirt walking down the road, and he was holding a baby wearing only a shirt and diaper. He described the man as about 5'7", between 140, 150 pounds, and he was in his late 30s, early 40s. So again, this appears to be the same guy. But unfortunately, again, Mitch also did not call the police, but he did drive up next to the man and asked him if he was okay. And the man said, yeah, I'm fine. So a little better, still not great. Again, I stand by what I said. I like you going up and approaching him and talking to him, but we need to identify this person. We need to make sure the baby's okay. And although I love civilians who get involved, I'd rather see an official law enforcement official do it, because they can document it, report it. And if there's anything else that happens in that vicinity, they'll be able to flag it. And I do want to point out that detectives met with Mitch and the PAR scale separately and showed them photo lineups to see if they could identify the man they had seen. Mitch did pick someone out, but the PAR scales didn't recognize anyone. And that could be because they just didn't have a right angle on the person. Although I don't think they would have showed them a photo lineup if they said they hadn't seen this man's face. It could also be that Mitch did have the right guy. And unfortunately, the PAR scale's memory of who they saw, it differed a little bit. And we have talked about this many, many times, how not all witnesses are created equally. And unfortunately, you can ask two people who are literally standing shoulder to shoulder about a vehicle that just drove by and was involved in a police shooting, and without any malice, they can both give you a different description. It's just the way it is. It's the same way two people study for the same test. Someone might end up with a higher grade. So you got to take in all the information, evaluate it, but understand that people can be wrong. But having both people identify a different person or not identify someone at all for any type of prosecution, that's going to be a major problem, and it's going to be music to the ears of a defense attorney. So now I want to go back a little bit and talk about the graphic that I just referenced where there was a mark on there that said video surveillance 2:15 a.m. because it's important. I think it's something that probably shows us the suspect and Lisa, even though there are some complications, and we're going to talk about it. So in addition to the man with the baby sightings that we had two witnesses physically see with their own eyes, detectives also obtained surveillance footage from a BP gas station located about 0.7 miles from the Irwin home. Now, this video showed an unidentified person walking along the road around 2:15 a.m. Unfortunately, the video footage was too grainy, or I would say too blown out, too overexposed to determine whether the person was carrying a baby. And we actually have the footage, and I'm going to play it for you now, and you can develop your own opinions. But I think as you're seeing it on the screen right now, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see what I'm talking about. You have the gas station where the camera is much closer, and off to the, in the distance on the left-hand side, you can see an individual walking down the road. It looks like they have a light-colored shirt on, although that just could be because of the night vision of the camera and the way it's designed. But to me, I would describe that as being overexposed or blown out. And you can barely even make out that it's a person. You know it is because the way they're walking, but you definitely can't see a face. You definitely can't see if they're carrying a baby or anything else for that matter. But when you take into consideration that we have two other reported sightings of a man with a baby around this time of night during these conditions, what's the likelihood that there's anybody else walking around with a baby in a diaper at that moment? And when you bring back up this map here, this overview, it's up on the screen right now, you could see the general direction that the suspect could have traveled. There's a couple main roads there where they could have started at the Irwin home, made their way by the BP gas station, and then ended up at that intersection where they were seen by Mitch. So to me, it all adds up. And if I had to put money on it, what you're looking at in this video is our suspect. And more than likely, Lisa is in that shot. And just for full disclosure, because I know I'm putting a lot of emphasis on this video, the manager at that BP gas station said it was very unusual to see anyone walking around during that time of the night. However, a police spokesman said that the video showed nothing of value. And some people were saying, how could you say that? With everything that I just described to you guys, a lot of people have come to a similar conclusion. How can the spokesperson for the law enforcement agency working in this case say there's nothing of value here? I think it could have been worded poorly. There's definitely value here. It kind of confirms the two witness statements that we have. But from the angle of pulling information from this video that could lead to the suspect, I understand that perspective. I see the video. I've deduced a few things from it. It's speculation on my part. But at the same time, I can also see that there's nothing in this video, from what I can tell, that would lead us to baby Lisa. So if we're looking at it that way, I understand what he's saying, but it could have been said a lot better. I wouldn't diminish what we're looking at here because realistically, it could be the last known footage of baby Lisa. So as the investigation continued on October 5th, a news conference was held so that Jeremy and Deborah could speak directly to the public. They said they didn't know who would want to take Lisa, and they pleaded for her safe return. For the rest of the day, Deborah and Jeremy endured long hours of intense questioning. At this point, it was clear to them that detectives were beginning to focus on Deborah as a suspect, so she decided to hire an attorney to protect herself, but eventually she continued cooperating with investigators. And I kept this short right here, but there is more context to this. It got pretty heated between Deborah and the police. They basically were accusing her of killing baby Lisa. They were really pushing it, really forcing it, and she got defensive, and understandably, she hired an attorney. Now, is Deborah involved or not? I don't know, but I understand either way why you would hire an attorney, and I don't blame her for doing so. If you're getting grilled and you truly had nothing to do with it, and you can see where it's going, where they're directly telling you, you killed your daughter. Yeah, I think you're going to get defensive too, and you're well within your right to hire a lawyer. So I don't blame her for doing so. And the good news here is whatever transpired inside that station, eventually cooler heads prevailed and Deborah came back to the table and continued to be cooperative with law enforcement. So that's great. And according to KMBC, once everything was back on good terms, Detectives returned to the Irwin home to recreate how the abduction might have happened. They climbed in and out of the computer room window, testing whether someone could have entered that way. They found that it wasn't easy. The half-bent screen made it awkward, and the process created a lot of noise. Detectives said it likely would have woken up the people inside the house if someone had entered that way. And after the reenactment, it seemed like detectives were still focusing on Deborah, so she underwent a 9-hour interview conducted by a former CIA officer and deception expert who wasn't part of the case. And this interview, it proved to be pretty critical, as Deborah revealed some new information that she had never disclosed before. You see, when Deborah was asked if she had any involvement with Lisa's disappearance, she said, quote, none. But after a pause, she added, quote, the only thing I did wrong was drink that night and possibly not be alert, not here. And she became visibly upset after that admission. According to HLN, Deborah went on to explain that on the evening of October 3rd, she had shared 5 to 10 glasses of wine with her neighbor, Samantha, which made her very intoxicated. Deborah went on to say that she actually put Lisa in her crib around 6:40 p.m., not 10:30, like she originally claimed. After that, Deborah and Samantha sat on the front stoop, drinking wine and smoking cigarettes. At around 10:30, Deborah told Samantha she was going to bed, Samantha left, and Deborah went inside. And she was so drunk that she wasn't even sure if she had checked on Lisa before lying down. However, as far as she can remember, she thought her door was still closed. Deborah said that she went to bed, and soon after, her son came in and fell asleep beside her, and that's all she could remember. But no matter how hard the expert pressed her, Deborah kept insisting she had nothing to do with Lisa's disappearance. In the end, the expert thought she was telling the truth. He later told HLN that, in his opinion, it was, quote, highly unlikely that Deborah or Jeremy had anything to do with their daughter's disappearance. Deborah still had the difficult job of coming clean to detectives investigating Lisa's disappearance, as well as the public. And to her credit, she did both things, even going on the Today Show to admit that she had left parts of her original story out. There's a lot to unpack here. What do we take from all this? At minimum, not the best parenting skills. I think we can all agree on that. You have an 11-month-old baby in the house. Should you be drinking 5 to 10 glasses of wine to the point where you can't even remember if you checked on your baby before going to sleep? I think most people would agree that's not the way you do things. Does it mean she had anything to do with the disappearance of Lisa? Not necessarily, not directly anyway, but I think we can all admit that being that intoxicated does make you susceptible to being a victim of a crime. And if there's someone in the area who has malicious intentions, they may see your inebriation as an opportunity. So is it possible that someone may have slipped by while she was out there drinking? Of course it is. And she can't deny it because, as I said, she's not even completely sure that Lisa's door was shut when she went back inside. For all we know, whatever happened to Lisa happened during that window and not after she went to bed. So yeah, not great. We have to acknowledge it. I give her credit for coming forward, and it takes a lot of courage to do so, but I would have preferred if she told the truth in the first place, because I'm sure everybody's sitting here now asking yourself, well, what else was she lying about? And that's a reasonable question to ask. You only have one chance at the truth, and once you destroy that, naturally you're going to lose credibility. Around the same time that this interview with Deborah is going on, an FBI cadaver dog was brought into the Irwin home. Now, the dog alerted in Deborah and Jeremy's bedroom near the bed, and detectives then spent several days searching the house for DNA evidence, but ultimately nothing came of it. And I did see a video from the attorney. She possibly was representing Deborah, or maybe Deborah and Jeremy, and she was asked about this, and nothing was destroyed in the house. The law enforcement officers were in there for a couple days, and she was pretty understanding of the whole thing. She said, listen, they're doing their job. It's a very difficult job. They got to start at the foundation of this crime, which would be the house. And I thought she answered the questions well. It doesn't seem like she was pushing back, trying to make Jeremy and or Deborah victims, which I appreciated because, yes, they could be. But at the same time, they're also where this whole thing started. So understandably, they're going to be in the middle of it. There's no way to avoid it. So I liked the interview, and I thought the attorney was fair. And just so I don't skate over it, the cadaver dog hitting in the bedroom. We've also talked about dogs a lot on this channel. I don't know. It's hit or miss. I will tell you that the dog is only as good as the handler. And without seeing the dog and the handler myself, it's hard for me to put a lot of emphasis on this hit. I was in charge of the canine unit for a while, and it was touch and go. If we had someone good with the dog, it could be great, and I would trust the dog on any case. There were other situations where you have a handler who's phoning it in, not putting in the proper hours and training, and then you're susceptible to missing things or getting false positives. So it could be something, it could be nothing. The fact that they went into that room and spent several days in there, even though from what I understand, they didn't remove any carpeting or anything like that. It seems to me like if there was something in there that would suggest baby Lisa was killed in that room, they would have found it, and they didn't. So that's what we have. And even though that's where we are, detectives kept digging, focusing on phone records for the three cell phones that went missing from the Irwin home. And during that search and during that investigation, they learned that on the night of Lisa's disappearance, one of those phones was used several times less than a mile from the house. Now, the first activity was at 11:57 p.m. when an outbound call lasting 50 seconds was made. Then between 3:17 and 3:32 a.m., the phone was used again to browse the internet and check a voicemail. Further details about that activity have never been released. However, we know that when detectives traced the phone number that had been called at 11:57, they learned it belonged to a woman named Megan Wright. And man, this is just the tip of the iceberg. Wait till I tell you where this all went, because they found Megan. We're going to talk about it right after the break. Ever wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable? The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep, and that's why I switched to Miracle Made Sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep perfectly all night long. Hot sleeper, cold sleeper, doesn't matter. These sheets help keep you in the comfort zone all night long, and thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle Made Sheets stay cleaner and fresher up to 3 times longer than regular sheets. That means fewer odors, fewer wash cycles, and less laundry. And the most important part, in my opinion, they feel just as good, if not better, than sheets you'd find in a 5-star hotel, but without the steep price tag. They're smooth, breathable, and ridiculously comfortable. They're also great for your skin. All that hidden bacteria in regular sheets, it can clog your pores and cause breakouts. But Miracle Made's antibacterial design helps you sleep cleaner and clearer night after night. So upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest by going to trymiracle.com/detective to try Miracle Made Sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use my promo code DETECTIVE, you'll also get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set, which makes an amazing gift. And with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk, so head on over to trymiracle.com/detective today. Check them out. You won't regret it. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this week's episode. Right now, the headlines are chock full of data breaches and regulatory rollbacks, making us all vulnerable, but you can do something about it. Delete Me is here to make it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online. If you want an easier way to deal with data breaches, get Delete Me. The fact is, we're all at risk. How many times have you gotten an email or a letter saying your data has been breached? It's unsettling, but the good news is Delete Me can help. Delete Me knows your privacy is worth protecting, so sign up at www.joindeleteme.com/detective and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And Delete Me isn't just a one-time service. Delete Me is always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing your personal information you don't want on the internet. That's why the New York Times Wirecutter has named Delete Me their top pick for data removal services. We're all getting these scam text messages and emails, and you know, they're not legit. And when you see those, you know that your data has leaked somewhere, and we're all susceptible to it. I don't care who you are. I'm in the PI field. I still get those text messages all the time, and I'm just as vulnerable as you are. And it's more easier than ever to find personal information about people online. Having your address, your phone number, and your family members' names hanging out on the internet can have actual consequences in the real world, and it makes everyone vulnerable. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now at a special discount for my listeners and viewers, you can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to www.joindeleteme.com/detective and use promo code detective at checkout. The only way to get that 20% off is to go to www.joindeleteme.com/detective and enter code detective at checkout. One last time, in case you just didn't hear me the first few times, that's www.joindeleteme.com/detective. Code detective. All right, so we're back. And before break, I had mentioned this woman, Megan Wright. Her phone number was traced back to this 1157 call. So understandably, immediately law enforcement goes to Jeremy and Deborah and says, hey, do you know this woman? And they both say no. So detectives went to speak to Megan and reportedly she denied speaking to anyone on her phone at 1157 that night. And according to what we gathered, Megan told detectives that she lived in a trap house with seven other people that she often let use her phone. And just for anybody who's not following, you know, TV movies, trap house, drug house, it's a squatter's house. There's just a lot of people living there. Most of the time, some unsavory characters. There are cases where it's just people down on their luck, but not the place you want to be in. You definitely run into some trouble there. There's no doubt about it. And from what I can find, detectives were able to interview at least two of her roommates who admitted to using the phone, but they said they had nothing to do with Lisa's disappearance. When detectives asked Megan if she knew Lisa or her family, she said no and that she hadn't even seen Lisa until her photo appeared on the news. But then they asked her if she had been in the Irwin neighborhood, and surprisingly, she said yes. And she went on to explain that she had gone there with her ex-boyfriend, John Tanko, also known as Jersey. And you didn't know this up to this point, but detectives were already aware of this guy, Jersey, as many people in the area reported him being someone that they should look into for Lisa's disappearance. And Jersey was a man who was in his 20s and was often homeless. Now, at the time that Lisa went missing, he was staying at a house just around the corner from the Irwin home. And he often did handyman work in the area and was frequently seen riding his bicycle through the neighborhood. According to HLN, Jersey had a criminal record spanning more than a decade, including convictions for arson, burglary, and other offenses. Detectives showed Jersey's photo to three witnesses who had reported seeing a man walking with a baby that night. Mitch said Jersey was definitely the man he had seen, but the Parscales said the man they saw didn't look like him, though they couldn't be certain. And this goes back to that example I was explaining earlier where it seems like Mitch, who was able to speak to this person directly, they had a conversation. He was the guy who said, yep, that's him. I talked to him. I know what I saw. This is the same guy. The guy I talked to that night who had a baby in his hand, I approached him, asked him if he was okay, and he said yes. And that's the same guy in the photo you're showing me. The Parscales, who were a little further away from their home, are saying they don't think it was the same guy, but they can't be certain. Who are you going to go with? I know who I'm going with. I will say it still hurts the case because a defense attorney is going to rip this apart. But if you made me choose, the much more credible witness here is Mitch, not because he's telling me something that could lead to an arrest, but because he had a direct encounter with the person we're looking for. So when he says it's Jersey, I believe him. And speaking of Jersey, detectives also spoke to him directly, and no shocker here, he claimed he had nothing to do with Lisa's disappearance. What was surprising to me is that after that interview, detectives said they were moving on from the Jersey lead. Now, they weren't completely ruling him out as, quote, everything was on the table. However, they were satisfied with the answers he had given for now. And I do want to point out that to this day, Jersey has never been officially named as a person of interest or a suspect in Lisa's disappearance, which is very surprising to me. I don't know what law enforcement knows that we don't, but at minimum, I think we can all agree that he's a person of interest. I would go as far as saying he's a suspect, but how do you say you're moving on from him? What could he have possibly said that would have given him complete exoneration for this crime? And if he did have complete exoneration, a la an alibi that puts him somewhere else where you can confirm it, then why wouldn't you just say you're ruling him out completely? How is everything still on the table and yet you're moving on from the guy who was positively identified by a witness who saw this guy allegedly with a baby around the time that Lisa disappeared. I don't get it. I feel like I'm missing something. These are the cases where I would love to have one of these investigators come on here and get the opportunity to have a conversation with them. And I don't want to get too off the tracks here, but I told you guys about a new show that I'm going to be coming out with that's more of an interview style show. The set is right here. It's being built next to me. I'm really excited about it. And I will tell you straight up, if I have the opportunity to interview some of these investigators, these detectives that work these cases to answer the questions that I have, and I know the questions you have, we're going to use that platform for it. I can guarantee you that. But as of right now, that's all we got. I don't like it, but that's where we are. As the investigation moved into November, the case took another unexpected turn. On November 6th, Jeremy's debit card was used on a British website that allows users to legally change their children's names. Jeremy noticed the charge and immediately showed it to the FBI. But when agents tried to access the same website, it redirected them to a stationary company page instead. Now, investigators ultimately concluded that the charge was likely unrelated, just another stolen card used online. And without having the information in front of me, I agree with them. That's probably what happened here. It would be pretty stupid for someone to steal a card months later, because I don't believe it was stolen at the time of Lisa's disappearance, and to use it to legally try to change an abducted child's name. So I do feel like it's an unfortunate coincidence. Can't 100% say that, but I feel like if there was something here, it would be easy to reverse engineer, and that doesn't appear to be the case. But after this development, the case began to stall. Tips continued to come in, but none of them led to Lisa. As years went by, investigators released multiple age progression photos showing what she might look like as she grew older, but very little new information was shared with the public. Unfortunately, there have been no other major developments in Lisa's case. It's been just over 14 years since she disappeared, and authorities have never named a person of interest or a suspect, and they have also never said what they believe happened to her. Lisa's parents continue holding on to the hope that she's alive somewhere. They still search for her and speak out regularly to keep her story in the public eye. And they've made it clear, they won't stop until they find her and bring her home where she belongs. Okay, so let's dive into this perspective. And first off, before I dive into my theories on what could have happened, I'm going to start with the good news. I think it's a very good possibility that Lisa is still out there, that she's still alive. And unfortunately, she was too young when she left to remember who she actually is. But if we continue to talk about the story, if we continue to cover it, maybe eventually something happens where she realizes that wherever she is right now, whoever she's with right now, is not being truthful. And there's more to her story. And I don't even know how it would happen, but in some way, shape, or form, she realizes that she's someone other than what she's been told. So that's the good news. She's out there somewhere. But based on what I just told you, it's not likely that she's going to solve her own case, which means we have to do it. And in order to do that, we have to know who's responsible for taking her. And I'm going to start with the obvious theory that I have to mention, even though I don't know if it's the case here. And that's the parents, specifically Deborah. Is it possible that Deborah and or Jeremy, although I'm leaning towards just Deborah, was down on her luck, was involved in something, or maybe Jeremy was, where they decided to give Lisa up? They set this whole thing up to make it look like an abduction when in reality it was planned. And she's with someone who they know. And this was something that maybe they received money for. Although if that's the case, you would think over the years, detectives would be able to follow up on that and track that down. There's also the small possibility that Lisa was killed inside that home. We talked about the cadaver dog and that potential hit. Was there a tragic accident, or was there a murder where something happened in that home, maybe while Jeremy wasn't around and they disposed of Lisa's body? That's also possible, especially when you consider the fact that Deborah has come forward and said, yeah, I was extremely intoxicated that night. I don't even remember if Lisa's door was closed. Well, let me throw another scenario at you. Deborah does go back inside, and instead of going directly to bed, She does go to Lisa's room because maybe Lisa's crying. And at that point, she takes Lisa out of her crib. She's upset because she won't go to sleep. And it could be an accident that went terribly wrong, or it could be intentional where Deborah loses her cool and hurts or kills Lisa. And at that point, she realizes what she's done and she gets rid of any evidence of it before Jeremy gets home. And she would have had plenty of time to do so because, as I mentioned, he got home so late, middle of the night. So then finally she goes to bed. He wakes her up and she plays dumb. Can I sit here and tell you that's not a possibility? No, I can't. And I hate to accuse any parent, especially a parent who's went through something like this. But I think if Deborah listens to this episode, she would even acknowledge that, although it may not be true, it's a possibility. And I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't mention it. But now I want to turn to what I think really happened here. And I think it's a combination. And I will say Deborah is partially to blame for this. Being in that condition, it created an environment where someone could take advantage of her and her household. I think we're looking at a situation here where Deborah was extremely intoxicated. This was not the best of areas. Someone might have been casing the joint, seeing Deborah in this condition. It may have even been someone that Samantha knew. By the way, detectives really need to look into Samantha if they haven't so already. Maybe not her directly, but the people she's surrounded by. Did she leave that house and tell someone that, quote unquote, Deborah was really drunk? And what's the group of friends that she hangs around with? Did she say something to the wrong person who then went and took advantage of the situation? That's also possible. And I really hope that that lead has already been followed because, yes, they're looking at Jeremy. They're looking at Deborah. They're looking at the people they were around. But Samantha was there that night as well. And she knew that Lisa was inside and she knew that Jeremy wasn't home. So where did she go after leaving Deborah's home and who was she with? That's what I want to know. But back to the Irwin household. They're in this area. There's some people that we know of who are in that neighborhood at that time, one of them being this guy, Jersey. And they could have seen something where maybe they've been there before. Maybe they've seen Jeremy's vehicle before and realized that he wasn't home. So that coupled with the fact that they knew Deborah was in rough shape and it could have just been from them walking by and seeing her like that, they saw it as an opportunity to go inside and steal some things of value. Maybe not a baby, but something they could later pawn off or sell to a drug dealer to make some money or get some drugs. So this person could have went inside, saw the three phones at first, grabbed them, which to me right there suggests something, and we're going to get into that in a second. And as they're going through the rooms, maybe they peeked into Deborah's room. They continue down the hallway. They see a baby and say, you know what's more valuable than the cell phones? This child. A lot of people are looking for a baby and don't have the means to get one. Maybe there's something here. You know what? I'm going to go for it. They grab the baby, not realizing they were going to take a baby. And that's why they're seen multiple times by witnesses and surveillance footage. So let's dissect that for a second when we think about the profile of this person and what the evidence in this case tells us about them. Well, first off, and I have a few things written down here. Clearly, they didn't have a vehicle, right? They walked at least 3 miles in a t-shirt with a baby in 40-degree weather at 4 o'clock in the morning. This also tells us that it wasn't pre-planned because if you had the intentions on abducting a child, you wouldn't want to be seen in public. So more than likely, you would have a means of transportation to avoid detection. And yet you didn't. And you were walking in plain sight, actually speaking with people while carrying the baby. So this was not premeditated. This is something that was a spur of the moment thing, which is why I lean towards them being in the neighborhood, seeing Deborah in a very inebriated state and deciding to act on it. And what does that tell us? It was spontaneous. In the moment, they decided, this is what I'm doing. Was it desperation? Was it the observation that this was an opportunity to make some money? Could have been a combination of both, but clearly there was no thought to this. You are running a high risk of being caught when you decide to enter someone's home without knowing what's behind that door. And yet this person did that, which to me at least gives us some level of desperation. That could have been the need for money, the need for drugs, a combination of both, but they went for it and they weren't really worried about the consequences. And when you consider the fact that whoever this person was, they decided to use the phone that they had just stolen from the same house that they abducted a child to make a phone call. And clearly this is a number they remembered. They had it somewhere, stored in their brain, and it was a number they had called before, and it went to this woman, Megan Wright. Now, was it Megan Wright? Probably not. But as we mentioned, this individual, this suspect, called Megan, who was staying with a bunch of people at a trap house. You are the company you keep. So that, again, leans towards the potential that this suspect, not some expert, not some professional, homeless individual, drug user, desperate for money, desperate for something of value that they can trade. And now after doing what they did, they're calling their acquaintance. They're calling a friend. They're calling a potential accomplice to let them know what they've done. And the last time they had spoken to this person was through the usage of Megan's phone. So it all makes sense as far as the profile that we're looking at here. This is a male in his 30s and 40s, desperate, probably a drug user with a previous criminal history, frequenting the Irwin neighborhood leading up to this incident. I'm sure this isn't the first time they've been there. And yet, if I had to guess, since this incident occurred, more than likely, that person has never been back. Although having said that, I do have some questions. And one of those questions are, why did this person feel confident enough to go in this home, even if they were desperate? What made them believe they could navigate this household without any issues, without running into someone who lived inside that residence? Is it because they've been there before? Is it because they knew Jeremy and or Deborah? Is it because they've been in that house on multiple occasions and knew they could get inside to baby Lisa without ever crossing paths with Deborah, not only because of the layout of the house, but also because of her current condition? When you think about that, it opens the door to a lot of different people. And you could be looking at a situation here where everything I just said about this person in their profile could be true, but it could also be someone that Deborah and Jeremy know, but they're just not aware of it, which leads me to another area that has to be explored. Yes, a lot of time has been spent on Deborah and Jeremy. An equal amount of time needs to be spent on their friends and family. Is there someone who they trusted who has been at that house on numerous occasions who may fit this profile, who may have been going through a tough time, who happened to be in that neighborhood on that particular night, and they knew that they could get in and out without being detected? And I would assume that that has been done to a certain degree. The question is, how deep have they gone? And the only positive thing I can say is it's not too late. If it hasn't been done before, they can still do it now. The other person you have to look at is Jersey or anybody else living in that home, because not only does Jersey fit the description, homeless guy looking for money in that area that night, not only that, positively identified by a witness who saw a man with a baby on the night she was taken. He's got to be on the list. I don't give a shit what law enforcement says. As far as I'm concerned, he's at the top of the list. And I don't know what has been done to follow up on him or to track him over the years, but from where I'm sitting, he's at minimum a strong person of interest. And not only is he a strong person of interest, but his associates, specifically the ones living in that home with Megan Wright at the time, they're all on the list. I'm following them. I'm tracking them down. I'm bringing them in year after year to see if they trip up, because if they do, I'm going to be there to catch them, because I want to know what's going on, what they're involved in, and what information they have now that can help me, quote unquote, help them. If you know what I mean, we can help each other out here. You know what happened in that house? You just got into some stuff. Maybe I can get you out of it. What do you know about baby Lisa? That's what I'm referring to. The only other thing that I want to mention quickly, and I'm thinking about it as I'm going through this perspective, although it's not at the top of my list, like I said, Jersey's at the top of my list, is just potential neighbors, right? We haven't really talked about that this evening. Was there someone living in that neighborhood who had seen Jeremy and Deborah with Lisa, and in their opinion, Lisa was not being treated properly? The parents were not taking care of her the way she should be taken care of. They could have perceived what they saw that night with Deborah being on the stoop drinking as a form of child abuse, negligence, where maybe they had seen this many times before, and every time they did, it aggravated them and they wanted to do something about it. So when Deborah stumbled back inside, they decided to take matters into her own hands. Now that would be the noble, I guess, explanation for it, although it's still not right. I'm not justifying it. The other angle here is that there's some scumbag living near the Irwins. They know the dynamic of that household. They know when Jeremy's home and when he's not home, and they know that when he's not home, maybe Deborah's drunk all the time. So if you want to steal a child and you're looking for an easy way to do it, and you live in that neighborhood, maybe you've been to that home before for a cookout or a get-together, and so you know where baby Lisa sleeps, and now you see Deborah go inside for the night, maybe you climb through the window, go inside, grab Lisa, and then get out of there. The only problem that I have with that theory and why I'm hesitant to even mention it here is, what would be the explanation if you live close by for walking 3 miles to this random highway? Where are you going? Why wouldn't you just bring her back in your home, keep her there for at least a day or two, and then move on? I guess the answer would be, well, what if law enforcement stops by my house and they start to question me? Now I'm caught. But if that's the case, and you're walking around the neighborhood with baby Lisa, you're still running the risk of being caught. So I'm explaining this to you. I'm not going to edit this out. This is my thought process as I go through this case. And yes, I see some potential with it, but then I can also debate myself. And as I do, my rational, logical side of my brain tells me more than likely this is not what happened, because the behavior that was conducted afterward wouldn't align with someone who had a place to go to that was in close proximity. This is someone who was in the area, had to get out of there, had nowhere to go, was desperate, stupid, and just decided to walk and hope for the best. So as I wrap this perspective up, that's where I'm at. I think Jersey's at the top of the list, or someone like a Jersey is more than likely responsible for this crime. This was not some professional abduction. This was not premeditated. This was a victim of opportunity, spur of the moment event. I don't know how they saw what they saw, but they did, and they took advantage of it. And unfortunately, they got away with it. But it's not too late. As I said at the top of this perspective, I do believe that Lisa is still out there somewhere and she's alive. She doesn't know who she is, and that's why we have to find her. And I'm hoping someone out there right now watching or listening can help us do that. So just to recap, on the evening of October 3rd, 2011, nearly 11-month-old Lisa Irwin was last verifiably seen at around 6:40 p.m. when her mother, Deborah Bradley, said she put her down in the crib for the night. Sometime between 3:45 a.m. and the next morning, Lisa disappeared from her home on North Lister Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri. When her father, Jeremy, returned from work, the front door was unlocked, lights were on throughout the house, and Lisa was gone. At the time of her disappearance, Lisa had blue eyes and a, quote, small tuft of blonde hair on the top of her head. She was about 30 inches tall and weighed between 26 and 30 pounds. She had two bottom teeth, a bug bite under her left ear, and a birthmark on her right outer thigh that looked like a freckle. If anyone has information about her case, please call the Kansas City Crime Stoppers at 1-816-474-8477. There is a $100,000 reward available. And my final words, as always, go out to Jeremy, Deborah, and their friends and family. I know I didn't have all positive things to say about you guys tonight, but if you're not involved, then we both want the same thing. We want to bring baby Lisa home. We want to reunite her with her family. We want to find the person responsible and make sure that they're held accountable. And in order to do that, objectively, we have to explore all scenarios. And that includes the possibility that maybe you even indirectly contributed to her disappearance. That could be just someone you knew who took advantage of the situation. So if you happen to listen or watch this, think about that. Maybe these questions haven't been asked yet. And if they haven't, bring them to the attention of the investigators working your case. They need to be explored. It's not too late. As I said in the episode, I believe Lisa's still out there somewhere. She doesn't know who she is. We just got to find her and let her know that she's loved, she's missed, and we want to bring her home. I hope I have an update on this case soon. I know it's been a while, but we have cases that have been older and colder, and they've been solved. And I'm hoping that this is another one of those cases. So if we have an update in this case, I will let you guys know. But until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.